When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, no, this is my husband has like this. The whole thing. It's not a mic. Obviously, it's like a whole thing, but it's.
So what else is it?
I mean, it's a microphone. It's
for our
phone.
Listeners,
it's
if like we end up phone. Using this, our guest has a microphone the size of my head. Oh, I see what you're saying. It's a big giant.
There's, looks like the robot monster home.
It's a microphone with like a foam head around it. Is basically what's happening.
It's a giant foam head.
My husband does voiceover work. So he has a little bit more of this kind of tech. I mean, apparently this is not that great, he says, but it's better than what my computer provides. So
it sounds fine.
I'm not joking. It is maybe twice the size of her head.
I don't think it really is.
Oh, okay. I see. It's up front.
It's a little forced perspective.
It's actually only
situation.
The size of her head.
It looks like it's so big.
It's
Can we
yes.
do the whole show about the microphone, please?
We could. I think, Joe could just spend an hour talking about forced perspective and its use in 50
And if you're just going to hide behind it, which you were doing earlier.
Yeah, I will. Well, I'm also scared. David said that I'm supposed to be talking into the microphone, too.
Right.
I have
fine.
To look at you guys through the side corner.
No, you don't. It's coming across fine.
Okay. Look,
we're still trying to get Joe to talk into the microphone. We get mail, folks. We get mail. We hear you. You try telling an established member of the DGA for 47 years that he needs to talk into a microphone. It's
not that I need to talk into the microphone. I need to not mumble. I need to not enunciate.
That's me. You enunciate quite well. I mumble, but I mumble into the mic and you talk away from the mic.
Well, and, you know what? I would say that, actors are the ones that are supposed to be trained how to speak mm-hmm. into a microphone, but yet so many actors, I can't even hear them in a scene when I'm 2 feet away from them. You know, I have a loud voice and I was trained in the theater. I mean, you know, I went to school for theater, so I was trained to project. So
it's a good
probably
thing.
Don't need such a big microphone.
When did that change? I remember, I don't know. I got into a thing in the early '80s with a bunch of friends. We watched 24. Ironically, I want it noted, and I noticed, and it wasn't the first time I noticed this, but it really hit me that like the new thing for the last few years, at least in TV, was that everybody talked like this. No matter what was going on, there's a terrorist. He's got a gun. Shoot! No, freeze. It was so weird. Like, when did that happen? When did
you
that
watch
become?
Too many golf games?
This was a show about a guy chasing people with nuclear bomb suitcases. It was very.
Maybe it was helped to like it was, that show was so intense. Maybe yeah. it helped bring down the intensity. But that was a good impression.
Thank you. Yes. No, I've often thought I should do voiceover work. We're by the way, here's the crazy thing. The odds are. More people listening to this show, if you play it anywhere in the world, will know just by her voice who our guest is. Because am I incorrect that like any given moment, Bones is showing in 43 different countries?
Probably. But here's the thing.
Yeah.
My sister is also an actor.
Right.
And she has we have very similar voices in that I sometimes can't tell the difference if I hear one of our voices recorded.
Oh,
so,
well, wait a minute. Which one of you will get bigger ratings for us? Because we can just.
I think we know it's not me.
86 years.
We are here with Caleb Deschanel, folks. Yeah. It's no,
just Sam, my sister. I know that's what I can say that to get voiceover work. Just like pretend it's Zoe.
Allegedly, I don't want to get anyone in trouble. My understanding is that most of the time when you think you're watching Martin Sheen doing a car ad, it's his brother, Joe Esteves, who sounds just like him.
No way.
That is my understanding. I could be wrong.
Well, hey, I should be using this to my advantage here.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a bunch. Yeah, no, I would. Because here's the great thing. Even if he's doing it and I don't know anything and I could be just, I have no intention. I want to stand for the record. I know not what I speak. But it seems to me that like if you had a terrible relationship, you know, with this person, you can still do it. Like, what's your brother going to do? Sue you for, you know, going out and making a living, trying to sound like him. It's just,
you're not saying who you are. You're just
right.
Speaking.
Yeah.
Do you have a legal department that can, can tell you if that's okay to say?
Yes.
This is The Movies That Made Me with your hosts, Josh Olson
and Joe Dante.
We are talking to the great and wonderful Emily Deschanel, who a longtime friend of the show, actually, because she helped us lure one of our big guests a while back. We got her dad, Caleb Deschanel. And he was a wonderful guest, by the way. Thank you. Thanks for your help with that.
You're so welcome.
And I've been trying to get Emily on for a while. And I want to ask you a serious question before you jump in, because she sent me an email a little while ago. And she was apologizing for the fact that she's going to talk about some of her favorite films, that it wasn't, I think you used the term highbrow enough. I hope I'm not revealing any secrets here.
No, not at all.
And Joe, I think it's safe to say I spend more time talking to people about coming on the show than you do. But, you know, you've talked for T-Run, like, we have a thing that I've slaved over, that we send folks. I talk to people. I've got friends who are afraid to come on the show still, no matter how much we stress that we are not about academia, we are not about.
No matter how much we tell them, we are determinedly lowbrow.
We just want to know what you think. We don't care. It's not like, what are the movies that moved you? What matters to you? That's the only thing that matters. People are like, well, I'm afraid that you're kind of just, I don't know. And you're like, you don't have to know. Some people come on and they just, you know, they wing it. Some people spend a week watching every movie they're going to talk about and studying them. Some people just, it's just like, we just want to talk to you about movies. That's it. But what could I have possibly said to have gotten you over that hump sooner of like?
I think.
Because I know you said at one point you're intimidated.
If I'm honest, Josh, and I say this because we're friends.
Yes.
But I think I listened to some episodes and you kind of were like, well, some people think that's a schlacky movie. And it'll be like The Shining, which I understand. There's something, and I was like, schlocky, that's the word, or something like that. And I was like, I know you weren't saying it, but you're saying some people saying that. And I'm like, well, so that I feel like some of those things make me feel like I shouldn't say that I like The Shining. I things like that, but I'm not even saying I like The Shining. The Shining is like
fantastic film.
Well, first of all, I'm also
by the way, way more highbrow than any of the junk you said. So I'm just,
oh, any of the what?
Any of the junk you're going to talk about.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. No, it's true. But I love The Shining. Listen, I love highbrow too. And I love, like, I mean, well, a certain amount, but I feel like I love it in an intellectual way more than I actually connect with it emotionally.
Right.
I love being entertained. I love watching things that excite me and scare me and thrill me. And so sometimes that's an action movie, you know, sometimes that's a comedy. I mean, making me laugh, that's so big. That's a huge thing for me.
So what you're saying is you like to feel something when you're at the movies instead of just thinking about them.
Yeah. I mean,
oh, that's so lowbrow. That's, I don't know if you can even, we can't do this one, Joe. This is painful.
And I feel like I appreciate things that, like, listen, I took films that, I mean, I went to college for theater. I basically have I have a BFA, which means nothing whatsoever. I literally have a high school education, essentially. But I had film class in high school with an amazing teacher named Jim Hosney, who also went on to teach at AFI. And we would, and it was also like not necessarily highbrow, but it was film analysis and looking at different, you know, writing papers and Freudian analysis, different things. So you're looking at things from different ways. And I love that. But when I think about what made me excited about making movies or, you know, TV shows and entertaining people, it is more lowbrow. It isn't the like, oh, the thing that stimulates me intellectually to write a paper. It's the thing that makes me feel something emotionally, which
That's
well, I guess the question is, how many Bowery Boys and Three Stooges movies are on your list?
Yeah, because that's really what we judge you on. That is
I grew up with Three Stooges, absolutely. Three Stooges, all of the, I mean,
you know, women tend to not like Three Stooges.
What'd you say?
The Stooges are not popular generally with women, I found.
Oh, interesting. Well, you know what? I haven't really watched them again. They might be offensive. There's so many things.
No, they're not offensive. They're just silly, you know? I mean, there's two guys hitting each other. Three guys.
I love silly. Like, I mean, I love the movie Dumb and Dumber. I loved Dude, Where's My Car? Like that, those things, I love that kind of stuff. If you can make me laugh in that way, oh my gosh.
So have we talked about the Stooges before, Joe? My terrible, terrible Stooges history?
What's your Stooges?
We haven't talked about your terrible Stooges history, but we have on occasion talked about the Stooges.
I used to, I was a, I mean, I say this, you know, it's true. I was a latchkey kid in the sense that for several years, my mother was single and I would come home from school and I would go to around the corner, I'd go stay with the Popes for an hour and a half until my mom came home. And the Popes were three brothers. I mean, they had parents, I think. But there were three brothers. One was my age. The other two were younger. And they loved the Three Stooges like nothing else. And we would watch the Three Stooges because it was all on in the afternoon. And these three brothers would proceed to do to each other whatever it was the Stooges were doing to each other. And I'm not joking. It would always end in bloodshed.
And yeah. one of them grew up to make Jackass.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I'm happy to say they all managed to grow up, but it traumatized me. I was like afraid. It was just like, you know, you'd see something, you'd almost want to laugh. And then somebody next to you would do the exact same thing and there would be screams of anguish. So in later years, like in the past few years, have gone back and sort of acquired a latent life taste for the Stooges.
It's a good taste to acquire for sure. Yeah, but I can see where that's traumatizing. I have, as the mother of two boys who try to murder each other on a daily basis, I can completely envision that scenario happening.
Yeah, don't have a third is all I'm saying.
Yes, exactly. Don't have a third. That was the problem.
Three is not the charm.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to have any more. So I think we're good.
Well, Emily, do you, after all that, are you prepared to dazzle us and impress us with your erudition?
Of all the movies that
all
I love,
your fine taste.
Like, my fine taste. Okay, so yes, I would love to talk about so many different things, but I would love to start with This Is Spinal Tap.
Well, that's highbrow.
Christopher Guest movies in general, even though he did not direct This Is Spinal Tap, but I'm a huge fan of all of those films.
Yeah.
The first one being This Is Spinal Tap, and I want to say that I kind of looked at this as like, the movies that inspired me as I came of age. So I'm looking at a lot of, like, when I was thinking about films, these were films that for the most part were kind of part of me growing up and shaping me as a person. This Is Spinal Tap specifically for us as kids. We grew up with my dad being a cinematographer, traveling all over the world. So we went on location, different places.
Well, he took one, you?
What'd you say? Tokyo?
He took you with him?
Oh yeah.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, sometimes he would just do something in the summer and we'd go and it would just be the summer, or sometimes we'd go and visit, but there were good chunks where we went the whole time. So he actually directed a movie and he did it in the Seychelles, which is this gorgeous place off the coast of Africa in the Indian Ocean. And, we lived on this island called La Digue, which is like the third largest island. And there's like 100 of them, right? But it's probably the third island that most people live on. And we lived there for several months when I was 10 years old. And on the island, there was one store. And the store had, you know, old flour and, you know, some milk and, you know, the things you need. It's a general store, but, you know, literally there are 10 cars on the island. This is a very small, and the production brought in probably five of them or more, right? There were ox carts that drove people around in this island, you know? Wow. We went to school on that island. I mean, it's a gorgeous place. It's where, you know, people go on vacation. But we were living there, but not for
years. You're a little kid at this point.
I was 10 years old.
And do you want to, and among the lovely thing, were you getting all dreamy over Aidan Quinn, or was that?
No.
Not yet. Okay.
I mean, I could totally see that now, but I was 10. So like, okay. I can see how he's totally dreamy. But as a 10-year-old, I was not interested in boy. No. But I did have a boyfriend named Michelle. I did not know that he was my boyfriend, but he was my boyfriend. Everyone told me. But I mean, it was wonderful for a kid growing up in Los Angeles to go and live on an island. And, you know, I could bring one toy, and we were had to be so creative anyway. And we went to school there. It was a completely different thing. We had to learn marching in school because they go into the military. Anyway, this is a very long preamble to the story that I want to say, which is that they had three VHS cassettes that you could rent from this store on the island. One was an animated movie of, I think, Watership Down or something.
Oh, sure.
But it was with
very dark.
Yeah, with rabbits or whatever. Yeah.
Yep.
Very dark. So I watched that once. The second VHS was the VHS of the second half of the movie Gandhi.
Oh, sure, because that would have been two. Half. Yeah, they would, because
just the second
2-hour
half.
Tapes. They would come in those big boxes. So just the second. Yeah. Okay. So and the later third years.
Was This Is Spinal Tap.
Wow.
That's an eclectic assortment.
So you can guess what the 10 and 7-year-old girls
watched
hundreds of times.
Yes.
This Is Spinal Tap. And my sister, being the performer, like since she was like came sprung forth, you know, out of the womb, was, you know, did a perfect Bobby Flackman impression, who is Fran Drescher.
Drescher,
first time we were introduced to her, Bobby Flackman, the hostess with the most. But my sister at 7 could do a perfect impression.
Oh, well, that's creepy.
You know, I mean, it's totally inappropriate in a lot of ways for kids to be watching this. And I think about having kids around the same age, actually.
I'm thinking of things like a lot of it you wouldn't get, I guess, like the herpes.
I did not get until later on, obviously. Money talks and bullshit walks. You know, we got to hear bad words and stuff that.
Harry Shearer and the cucumber in his pants.
Yes. We just thought that was so silly. I mean, I don't know. The dog call.
A man has a cucumber in his pants.
Oh my God. There's so many amazing performances in that movie. I don't know. I mean, there's so many memorable lines of like choking not on your own vomit, but on someone else's vomit. He died choking on someone else's vomit.
Not his.
Not his own. You can't dust for vomit. I think is the line, something like that. All, you know, improvised. Harry Shearer and I mean those guys, Christopher Guest, Michael McKean, who they're all just so brilliant.
I worked with those guys on Small Soldiers. They came in and did voices for the Gorgonites, who were the outcast toys. And of course, there was some stuff written, but almost everything in the movie was completely made up by these guys at the session.
It was, that must have been.
It was really
just
great.
So incredible to watch them just improvise and go.
Well, one of the things I learned years later, you know, after loving it, of course, which I also thought was really impressive and it works, is that if they shot something that would not have been allowed in a quote unquote real rockumentary, no matter how funny it was, they would cut it out. And there's, years ago, a Criterion version came out that had a whole bunch of outtakes. And, you know, there's an hour and a half of just screamingly funny material that's not in the film, but it's stuff that no band would have allowed into a movie about them. And they were just, they were ruthless. Like some of the funniest stuff they did is not in the film because they're like, this would not be allowed in a film about a rock.
Oh, I don't know if I've seen that. That's amazing.
It's pretty great. I mean, there's stuff with them doing drugs and, you know, things that you would have to shoot. And then you sort of go, they wouldn't.
I love that authenticity. You feel that authenticity.
Yeah.
You know, it really feels like it is a documentary crew that can't get an ideal angle, wherever they are. They're playing a part. People are aware of the cameras there. there, and if you will, rockumentary, I believe is what he said at the beginning. And if you will, rockumentary. So, I have to go back and watch that. I get to see so little things, so few things with the children, with young children that I have. So I will say that there, I have not rewatched a lot of these films that I'm talking about, but some of them I've seen many times.
Well, they'll be ready for Spinal Tap soon.
Yes. Yes. I really hope so. And some other Christopher Guest movies they might be ready for already, you know? I mean, you know, from Waiting for Guffman is one of my top favorites ever.
They probably like the dog show movie.
Yes. Dog,
that's what I'm thinking. Best in Show. That would be great. You could do a whole, you should do a whole show about good, about children's movies if you want to. What the good children's movies are.
Who is it? Somebody
to get some children to come on.
Yes.
Yes.
Try to get someone to do it. I can't remember who, but we came very close. But yeah, that'll be fun.
Yeah. There's so many good children's movies, and it's interesting. That's what I end up seeing nowadays.
Sure.
What else? Should we move on to other
other
things? I don't know. You guys can tell me, like, if you...
I think passing grade on that one, probably, right, Joe?
Yeah.
Yep, okay.
Passing grade?
Yeah.
It's
okay. But you still have a long way to go before...
But it wasn't really highbrow enough.
Yeah.
Well, then I'm in trouble because none of highbrow enough for you.
We've never had a guest storm off in a huff.
Just kidding.
You know what made Maron? You know what made his podcast? I was talking to a friend of mine. He reminded me the other day when he sort of skyrocketed from a, you know, because he was in the early days. It was when he had Gallagher on, and Gallagher got so pissed off at him that he stormed off the set. That's what. And that's what kind of catapulted Marc Maron's podcast.
Why did Gallagher get so mad at him? What did Marc Maron do?
He didn't do anything. He was just sort of asking him questions that I guess Gallagher didn't want to talk about.
Too personal.
Gallagher's a bit of a thorny character.
Other things, I'd say that, you know, I got really into Hitchcock. Those are slightly more highbrow than on the scheme of things.
he's kind of the schlocky side of highbrow. So
no,
we're unimpressed.
No, nothing's going to be highbrow. Nothing in this show is going to be highbrow at all. I don't think. Well, I don't know. I don't want to sell anything short. But there's going to be a range. Emily's range is like much more lowbrow. And then we're going to get some, you know, some will be slightly more highbrow, but that doesn't mean they're highbrow.
So it's really Emily's list.
It's Emily's list.
Yes. We have a title.
Do you guys have favorite Hitchcock movies?
Everybody's got a favorite Hitchcock.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I would say mine. I mean, Vertigo. I kind of have a love for Marnie too. I like the weirdness of that movie. And then, but I don't know. I got into so many of those, you know, I think in my high school year. So we started at 10 and now we're in my high school. I should maybe go chronologically. I don't know.
No, I want to go. So Vertigo, like how were you a kid when you saw Vertigo?
Teenager, I think. Maybe 13 or so. You know what I love too? I love plot twists. I'm going to talk about La Femme Nikita. That has such huge plot twist to me. I love female leads and I love plot twists. If I can like look at things that like really like get me excited. I mean, that's why I love that show Homeland too. Mm. You got crazy good plot twists and a female lead. Anyways. I love a good plot twist, and I feel like Vertigo has such a good plot twist. I mean, so does Psycho.
Sure.
I mean, you start that movie off, you think it's a completely different film than
with Janet
what it turns
Leigh,
into.
She's gonna star in this film, and right.
She, yeah, exactly. She's like running away. She's in her car. She gets to that hotel. You think this whole movie is going to follow her.
Right.
And then it completely.
Don't spoil it.
Okay. There may have been people who haven't seen Gus Van Sant's remake yet.
That's right.
Exactly.
But I'm still friends. So Vertigo is easily Hitchcock's highest brow film. Like that's the one with the most. It didn't. What was it? Sight and Sound, Joe, or something?
Yeah. It's leftover Citizen Kane as the you know, the most popular or the
greatest movie of all
time in that spurious list that Sight and Sound does. But it, you know, Vertigo is also a very adult movie. I mean, it's not. I wouldn't think that kids would be able to follow it because
yeah, that's why I'm fascinated.
It wouldn't be.
I was in high school.
Conceptually,
I was in high school. I wasn't so young, but you mean it? You mean for like children, or you mean even for a high?
You even,
mean
for high school? Because it's not like, you know, Rear Window. There's a murder. We're going to try to solve it.
Right.
Or Psycho. Or this,
well, but, I love Rear Window too, but Vertigo.
Vertigo is such a
so much more interesting. Yeah. To me. I don't know. I just love them all. I love them all. Honestly, well, maybe not them all. But
I'm going to send you a copy of Topaz and then we'll talk.
Yeah. I'm not sure I actually saw that.
Yeah, that's,
I feel like I saw that. I think I did see them all, though. I think like, or at least I saw as many as I could find at the store. And then, you know, again, the VHS tape we're talking about. But yeah, maybe I was very, you know, adult for my age.
I think a teenager so. who's digging Vertigo, that's pretty sophisticated.
Yeah, I was very sophisticated, and then I just went downhill. do you guys have, what are your favorite Hitchcock movies?
Well, I like them almost all, but Foreign Correspondent is one of my favorites.
Oh yeah,
it's just such a great movie. It's the art direction is incredible. There's a plane crash that's for 1940 is astonishing. It's got a great script. It's really funny. It's witty. But I mean, I it's typical of the good things about all the movies of his that I like.
Yeah. North by Northwest is so good too.
I love North by Northwest. Yeah. I mean, I bounce. It's like that or Rear Window or Notorious.
Notorious.
Because Cary Grant's so good. I mean, they're, you know, he never
so
gets
bad
the credit he deserves.
He's really good in it, but he's, the first time I saw that movie, I went, oh, I don't like him.
Yeah. Yeah. He's got such a dark edges in that one. And you don't expect that from Cary Grant.
But you can't.
There's always something good, as Joe says. That's true. Even in Topaz. But
even in Topaz that I don't even remember if I did see.
Is that the one with John Vernon?
Yeah. playing at Fidel Castro.
Playing Fidel Castro, yeah. Yeah.
So that, I don't know that. So I love the Hitchcocks. And then should I keep going?
Yeah.
I don't know how it all goes. How do I do this?
This is it.
We just go from picture to picture.
It goes like this.
Okay. The next one I have on my list is one of my number ones, but it's not like one I watched so much, but like I said, I'm thinking about these as like the movies that I loved as I came of age, but La Femme Nikita, Luc Besson. That film I just loved. I think especially being a woman, I guess I was a girl I don't remember when that came out, but I think I was a teenager, but seeing I was an aspiring woman. I don't know, coming of age. I don't know how old I was when I first saw it. But anyways, point is, I think it was just, I think, so important to me to see a woman kind of take back power, even though I guess she's being controlled. I mean, she's not having power, but she could fight and she was like given a gun to shoot. And it was so rare to see something like that. Also, a huge plot twist. That movie, you see, she has gone to prison. You think she's dead. You think she's been put to death. And then she comes back. Do you guys remember?
It has been a long time. I remember some of this. Yeah, because she doesn't they fake her death and then
they fake her death so she can become like a lethal assassin,
the super spy. But
yeah,
everyone thinks she's dead.
Yeah, and then she goes to spy school. It's so weird. And there's like Jean Moreau doing this beauty lesson for her with this crazy music, which is interesting too. Like you can't have a woman be an action star without her learning how to put on lipstick, basically. That's maybe part of what that is. Maybe that's a little problematic. I don't know, but I love that film. I think there's something there. I longed for that as a girl growing up. You don't see women having power or fighting or doing anything. And I think there's so many times where I felt like I didn't have the power in situations. So to me, emotionally connected when I could see films like that. And then, you know, I'll talk about Terminator 2 later too, on another highbrow film. but I completely stand by it. It's so entertaining and has a kick-ass woman. I mean, holy crap.
But even though, as you say, she's being controlled and all the rest of that, there's still, you know, it didn't hit me until much later in life that, like, as a boy, you know, I've been given every cheesy ass power fantasy I could ever want a million times over. And, you know, the satisfaction of just watching, you know, whatever, Bruce Lee clear a room of 50 bad guys or whatever. But girls, you know, you can count those on the fingers of two hands. How many times you just get those, you know, and it's dopey and it's cheap. But you should have that. You should get that. Yeah. I mean, it's never a surprise when a movie like that gets that kind of popularity. Cause it's like, yeah, make more of these.
Yeah. I longed for that. And I mean, now we can count that many. I feel like you couldn't count that many when I was growing up. There was so few films where women had any kind of physical power. You know, and I just wanted to see that. And now there definitely are, you know, you definitely see that. And I mean, I don't know what the statistics is, and Gina Davis is probably figuring that out, but I'm sure men are kicking a lot more butt than women are still in film, and they're speaking more and have four more roles than women.
I have a bit of, actually, it's funny. I've got a, I actually have a, Lady Rambo movie going into production in a couple of months.
I heard about this, Josh.
Yes, that's all I'm going to say. But we tried to make it a kind of, sort of use all the kind of action tropes that, you know, were given to Clint Eastwood and Sylvester Stallone and all that. And I remember reading when we were writing it, the Gina Davis thing where she was talking about lines. And I think it's a valid complaint that she has that there's some, she just basically, they broke out a year's worth of films. Is that it? And the number of lines given to women as opposed to men was just.
They analyze everything year to year. How many roles women, how many roles are by women? How many roles are by, you know, down the gender line. And it's also like for children and children's films, which is more important in a lot of ways because it shapes young people, obviously. But like what we're talking about, how I grew up longing for that and this didn't exist, right? So anyways, but she goes year by year. Right. Is that what you're saying?
Was fairly specific, basically the kind of thing we were doing. It's like, this is a taciturn ex-military, you know, she comes to town, they've killed her grandfather. She leaves a smoking crater where the town used to be. And, you know, she has less lines than anybody in the film because she's the action hero. You know, Clint Eastwood never says anything. He just shows up and goes,
Well, I think we tried to do that with her.
But if you were going to measure, I mean, it's like she's fully empowered. She demolishes every man in the film, but she also has way fewer lines than them because that's a thing of the genre. But I think the overall criticism is, of course, deeply valid. But like, I was very conscious writing this. It's like,
how many female roles do you have beside her?
Only a couple, because she basically kills everybody. We want them all to be men, but we do pass. There's a little old lady who runs a pot farm that helps her out, and they talk about something other than men. So we pass the Bechdel test.
Okay, nice. Yep. I love that. But you didn't get a makeup lesson with funky music.
No makeup lessons at all. When you said that, I remember saying, "Oh, damn, we should have done that." No makeup.
I have to look at what that music is that they play. And I apologize because if I had had more time, I would have gone back and watched, you know, some of these films so I can talk more eloquently. What'd you say?
I said she didn't prep.
You said she didn't prep.
I didn't prep. I thought I would more, but I'm sorry. I'm busy. Well, I'm a busy person with two children and a life.
The point is, it's like, We want to talk about the movies that you can talk about on a dime without having to prepare, you know?
Right.
So far, so good.
So far, so good. So I love those films. Mm-hmm. I also loved Heathers very much. And that was big in high school. And my friends and I would literally reshoot the entire movie on our weekends.
On what?
Oh my God, whatever camcorder.
Like on video?
Whatever parents have, video, you know, whatever.
Do you have any of these?
No, we shot it all on my friend. I mean, I remember it was like Abby Shaffron's house. Shout out to Abby Shaffron, who's a producer in reality TV, I believe. But yeah, we would record scenes from the movie and, you know, we'd pick straws or whatever who'd play Christian Slater because no one wanted to play the guy, you know, because it was all girls. Greetings and salutations. Though I do remember those amazing lines. And we were always fascinated by when the girl dies at the first, you know, at the beginning when she chokes, when she
falls to the table.
She's poisoned. Does she say corn nuts?
I think that's the line. Yeah. Corn nuts.
Corn nuts. These are the things that we would do. I mean, I think there's a, you know, I don't know. It's such that film just was so different and interesting and kind of dark. And then also had, you know, these interesting female characters, even if like they were all the bitchy girls. And I guess it's a precursor to Mean Girls and stuff later on, which was a little more like Heathers is so stylized in such an interesting way that I loved.
We should shout out to good friend and former, he's been a guest on the show, Dan Waters, who wrote Heathers.
And
whose brother directed Mean Girls, by the way, which
no.
Yes.
What?
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yeah, Mean Girls kind of the more commercial mainstream version of Heathers.
Yeah, but it couldn't exist without Heathers.
That is correct. And Dan, that by the way, that's going to be Dan's ringtone for the next year, is you saying that. So, or at least just what his brother calls.
Just what his brother calls.
Yeah.
Couldn't exist without Heathers. Couldn't exist without Heathers. I really, that film was so unique. Actually, Michael Lehman, who directed that film, was a family friend. So that felt kind of cool. It felt like.
Oh, you knew him then?
Kind of secretly cool. Yeah.
Oh, nice.
When we were kids. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Before he did that movie. So that kind of felt, you know, kind of cool to have some connection to that film. Loved another film from when I was younger. All of these are really from when I was younger. Running on Empty, Sidney Lumet.
Oh yeah, with I was River Phoenix, right?
River Phoenix. I was a huge River Phoenix fan.
Sure.
Who was it? What young lady wasn't, especially, I feel like, but he was just great. But I love this. So this film, have you guys seen that film?
It's not a little a long more time.
Obscure.
And comparatively highbrow.
Yes, very, very
comparatively highbrow.
We'll cut
and
this.
And I had to, you know, throw some things in. I don't know. I was fascinated by the story. Oh, go ahead.
It's a family on the run, right? They were political dissidents and weather underground kind of thing, and they have to hide out. Isn't it Judd Hirsch?
Yeah. Yes.
And who's the mother?
Christine
Lottie. Christine Lottie. Oh, God. Yeah, she's so good.
They're both so good. I just love that idea. I don't know. I think when I especially, you know, you kind of think about that stuff. You hear about people fighting for things they believe in, and they blew up a building and they didn't know no one was supposed to be there, but they blew up a building to fight maybe a war protest. Like mm-hmm. It was something like admirable.
Yep.
It was anti-Vietnam. Yes, it sounds right. And so they're on the run for their entire lives, basically. But then it's heartbreaking because their son is this prodigy musician and he's coming of age. And so like I don't know if they say Juilliard, but it's clearly supposed to be a school like Juilliard, right? I believe they might even say it. You know, he gets into the school. Well, now I'm giving away the whole movie. If anyone has never seen the movie, But so erase that. I don't know. I don't know if we're supposed to be encouraging people to see movies they haven't seen, or this is just supposed to be pure entertainment. I'm hoping this is supposed to be pure entertainment for people just to listen to.
Yeah. And then, by the way, it turns out Norman is his mother. That's probably not
right. It's maybe the first, the most likely film so far that people haven't seen, on my list, but
it's worth saying. I've been meaning to go back to it because it's a really interesting film. Were you a fan of it, Joe? Were you?
No, it's a, I thought it was terrific when it came out. Yeah. I think it was Franek's best performance too.
So, yeah. I agree. And I think too, I also love Sidney Lumet as a director, how you don't necessarily know a movie is a Sidney Lumet movie unless you see the credits. Like, to me, that, I don't know. I mean, I appreciate an auteur if you know, like, okay, that's a Hitchcock film, you know, before you see the credits. But I kind of love the fact that Sidney Lumet directed so many different types of movies, and he just made the movie that needed to be made, you know, told the story the way it needed to be told, rather than like having to kind of put his stamp on something. Not that people necessarily think that way when they're doing that, but I think because as an actor, that's how you want to do things too. You want to just like, you don't want to play every part the same way. You might end up playing every part the same way, but you should be trying to play it a little different. So, you know, you should be trying to approach it as a different thing. Right. And I would say none of these films are particularly like visually incredible. I mean, Hitchcock is so specific, and Heathers is very stylized in a lot of ways, but a lot of the films I would say are that I have, I don't know, I've, you know, like the documentary style of Spinal Tap, all of that. I love that.
Hey, we're going to be back with Emily Deschanel in a second, but we just want to take a minute to thank our sponsor, MoviesUnlimited.com, who all through the month of July are proudly showcasing women in film. These guys do great work. They're not just huge fans of our show, but you can get pretty much all the movies we talked about here on Emily's episode or any other episode at their site, MoviesUnlimited.com. It's really cool. They've got a page now set up for the movies that made me. For each episode. So you click on one, like here, you know, you got a Dr. Zayas's page and you click on it. And it's literally, it's not just every movie that he came to talk about. It's every movie that got mentioned on that episode that is available on video in some form or other. So you can go there and you can get your favorite movies from them. You're going to find classics, imports, hard to find films, new releases. Their prices are great. The choices are pretty much endless. And I got to tell you, man, physical media is the way to go. You can own all the titles you love. You can enjoy all the bonus features you don't get anywhere else. So
yeah, don't waste your time streaming or looking for your favorites on TV. You can own them. Click the Movies Unlimited banner.
MoviesUnlimited.com, the movie collector's website, where shipping is always free on orders over $50.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
And now back to our conversation with Emily Deschanel.
I love Terminator 2, another lady kicking butt. And just so action.
She's so amazing in that film.
Oh my God. Oh, I did not see the newest one. I literally have not seen a movie in years that like has come out. I end up seeing things at home because I have kids, but Love that film. Love like just being purely entertained and scared and surprised and just on the edge of my seat. And you know, yeah, seeing a woman taking power. I mean, she truly did have power. And I mean, she was fighting, right? And what an interesting plot twist to have like the Terminator, you know, switch sides in that film. But this is like the most mainstream film you could talk about, I think. But I loved it. And then another film and I loved, and it's not going to be a surprise now when you like are seeing some themes with me wanting that female character taking power, is Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, sure.
Another incredible performance by Jodie Foster. I mean, I pretty much love anything she does, really. But
that just rewatched that for like the first time, and that because I give the nod. Manhunter is still sort of my favorite of those.
I love Manhunter too.
But I get sort of like, you know, I was like, I've not seen Silence, and we watched it, and God, I forgot. I mean, it's just, I don't know. It's almost perfect, I think. Are you like, where do you come down on that? Joe, you must love that.
Well, it's terrific. I sat behind Jodie Foster at the screening that Jonathan set up. And when it was over, my girlfriend and I said, we're just glad you're alive still.
Yeah. Oh, that end sequence where she has the night vision. You see her through his night vision goggles.
And coming at her, and yes.
Oh, my God. It's just such a brilliant, I mean, so terrifying.
It felt out of left field for Demi. I mean, he'd done stuff that had elements, yeah, but it was just like that thing, just everything came together so well. And I just saw something recently where they just lifted, I've seen a bunch of things ever since where they've tormented you or played on the fact that you've seen that fake out. Remember when they go to the house and you think everything's okay, that it's somebody else's house, which is beautifully done. But I actually just saw something recently where they just did that fake out verbatim, and I was really annoyed by it. But
yeah, be more creative than that. That was so specifically, I mean, I don't think I never saw that specific fake out.
I had not seen that before either. Was that
before that movie?
We Joe has seen, I can't remember to say this, almost every movie.
It was a pretty new twist.
Yeah, that was incredible. Because remember that feeling when you're like the door opens and it's not, and you're just,
and it's not. And then you see him take the skin off or whatever. that movie, I will watch, like if I'm in a hotel room or wherever, you guys know, because you have to be in hotel rooms too. It's like if whenever you turn on television, if that movie is playing at any point, I will drop everything to watch that film.
Yeah, it's pretty easy to get sucked into.
Yeah,
and he's so good. We just saw
Anthony Hopkins. Oh my God! Oh, did you guys see The Father?
Oh yeah, no, we had the writer director on the show.
The writer director on. I have to, yes. Okay.
Shattered.
That film was incredible. That film was really incredible, and he did such an incredible performance. That's top performances of his. I mean, you know, we're talking a range for most actors can never reach. What does Tom?
Yeah, I was not prepared for how great he was going to be. We just watched the other night, what is it, When Eight Bells Toll.
Oh, an old one.
Yes.
And back in his drinking days, because he considers himself a completely different person now.
Oh, well, he is almost. It's like 1970. It's based on Alistair MacLean. I think it's based on Alistair MacLean. Yeah, it is one of his books, but MacLean also wrote the script. And I love those when I was a kid. And he's basically, it's essentially a sort of James Bondy kind of thing. And he's running around trying to stop some guys who are hijacking boats. And he's like in his early 30s. And there's just something, you can see how they were trying to turn him into something that he just wasn't quite suited for, because he's just not action man. But there were a couple of moments where, and in fact, one is with a woman who he's not sure he can trust or not. And of course, it's 1970. So of course, they take one look at each other and they're like, we must make love. But the look in his eyes, there's that thing that he didn't do a lot, or that I never noticed before until Hannibal Lecter, that he has this thing that he can do where his eyes just go cold and dead. That's so terrifying. And after having seen Hannibal Lecter, now watching this film, you're like, oh my God, he's going to kill her.
Right. Oh no, he's going to make sweet love to her.
Yes. 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 And then cook her up and eat her with a nice Chianti.
Yeah, exactly.
And fava beans.
And fava
beans and a nice Chianti. Yeah, and you love Manhunter. That's a great film too. That's Brian Cox in that one.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So fantastic.
He's no slouch either.
No.
I think he had the advantage of you hadn't. I certainly had most, but you had not seen him before. So there was always that possibility that Michael Mann had actually cast a real serial killing cannibal in the part.
Right. Yeah, it's Michael Mann. That's right.
That's right.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's terrifying. Fiends, you can't. And that story too is he is breaking in. Well, some people might not have seen Manhunter, so I'm not going to tell you how the killer kills. Right. But you can cut it out. But if I recall correctly, because it's been a few years since I've seen that, but it's like he did the home video. He was
the home film, the home movies. They were processing the home movies, and then he would case the homes by watching them because he worked at the lab.
That kind of thing creeps me out. And I don't think I slept for a good week after watching that film.
Yeah. Yeah. I would have stopped shooting home film. Like movies on, you know, Super 8.
Yeah.
I was still doing that when that movie came out.
Yeah. If that still was happening at that time, which it probably, was.
Pretty much, it was about to end.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. Now we just shoot them on our phones.
That's right. And they're perfectly safe there. No one can ever get to
No one gets that cloud is very safe.
Which is why all I do is just shoot stuff of myself naked because no one's ever going to get it. Because it's safe in the cloud. It's just locked down tight.
Gosh, I'm not so sure that it's as safe as you think it is.
Yeah, no, they call it the cloud. It's like it's impenetrable. You can't break through a cloud.
Clouds also drift away.
Nope. Nope. Rock solid.
You can reach right into a cloud, grab whatever nude photos you got in there, and pull them right out.
I might need to go do some erasing. What's next?
Okay, what's next? Oh, you know what? I think it's Truly Madly Deeply, which is, I believe, Anthony Minghella's first film.
Right. Right.
Or second film. It's one of his first films. And Juliet Stevenson plays a grieving. She's not a widow. It's her boyfriend who died of a cold. And have you guys seen this?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Because I don't know. I assume you guys have seen everything. But
Joe has. I've not seen
you've
it.
You've not seen it. Okay.
What?
You've seen this one.
Somebody brought it up a while ago, and I was like, oh, I gotta see that. I need to see that. I know I need to, and I haven't.
Oh, did someone else bring it up on this
show? Like a long time ago. It's all right. You're allowed. We don't.
I haven't listened to every episode.
I bet you they didn't say the same things about it that you're going to say. That's just my guess.
It's very possible. I will say the rest of their movies were not as lowbrow as mine, so I still win, I think. But
I bet it was Caleb.
Probably
hilarious.
Probably not. I feel like his would all be about. I actually never. I haven't listened to his.
Ooh.
I need to listen to him.
He was a good guest.
He was a great.
I bet he's a great guest, and I bet he talked about like French New Wave about a lot. I don't know. That's my guess, but which I love as well. Hey, Godard, Truffaut. I love it all. But I want to be the lowbrow guest. But Truly Madly Deeply is not necessarily lowbrow at all, but it's Anthony Minghella's first film. It's quite a lovely, sweet kind of portrait of grief in a certain way.
I think the first time many people saw Alan Rickman.
And Alan Rickman is incredible. So he plays the dead boyfriend and she's grieving and she gives this incredible performance. And then he comes back as a ghost to her life. And it's just quite lovely, but humorous. And then, I don't want to give it all away. It's just, especially Josh, if you've never seen it, I think it holds up.
It's the price I pay for doing this show.
That's the price people pay.
It's the price I pay.
The price you pay. Yeah.
Yes. Every now and then.
You're expected to see, as a cinephile, you have to see every movie, right?
Well, if you've seen Blythe Spirit, or if you've seen The Ghost of Mrs. Muir, I mean, you've got the template for what this is.
Blythe Spirit. I played the Rex Harrison part in a high school production of Blythe Spirit.
I've read Blythe Spirit as a play, of course, and I feel like I've done scenes from Blythe Spirit in acting class in school. But I don't think I've ever seen Blythe Spirit. Well,
David Lean movie. It's quite
based
good.
On the play, obviously.
Yeah,
it was originally a play, Joe.
I did see that. It was the role that made Margaret Rutherford into a star.
Maybe I did see that a million years ago.
It's in color, which is rare for.
I was going to say, is it black and white or color?
No, it's in color.
I guess it's in color. But it was that was a moment. Speaking of, you know, I guess you could do the theater that unmade me. That was when I decided I was not going to be an actor.
Our loss.
What was it that made you not? What made you feel
it's
like
it's hard, man? You know,
you got to remember lines. That's
That's the easiest part.
Oh, for you, I remember there was one, but the actress, she was the high school student who played my wife,
professional performer.
Yeah, we were both 17. There was a breakfast scene. I still remember this, the second act, where we would always blow our lines, but we had at least enough of a thing going on between us that we could kind of riff. I remember every night looking out, you'd see the director in the back and he was just losing his mind because we were just talking about just absolute twaddle and making it sound like it was because we kept forgetting the lines. It was just not a great scene.
But that's kind of great that you were able to. You didn't freeze. I feel like a lot of people would freeze.
Yeah, but we were not master improvisers.
Right,
you know?
Right.
I was like, oh, I would like some more English muffins, please. Oh, I think we're out of butter.
It's not Harry Shearer and Christopher Guest and Michael. Yeah.
No one was going, oh, wow, these are Noel Coward's best lines.
Yeah, right. It's like, is this, wow, I thought Noel Coward was
so realistic. It's like a docudrama.
He was so down to earth, that Noel Coward.
It's hard. It's really hard. You got to stand up in front of people. You can't be right. If I'm writing, I don't even have to wear pants. If I'm in a bad mood, it doesn't affect
me. He doesn't even have to wear pants when he does the podcast.
Good point. You want me to stand up? I mean, there's just so many things that can go wrong when you're doing this job that there's not a camera pointed at you. There aren't people sitting in a theater waiting for you to, like, that's terrifying.
If I'm
writing and I can't figure out what comes next, it's no big deal. I go off and play a video game and come back. But
I was going to say, doesn't it affect you if you're like in a bad mood? You go and play a video game and you just come back, but you're not on somebody else's time.
Yeah, exactly. That's no one's standing there looking at me going, oh, wow, he's in a bad mood.
Right, right. Well, can't you do the scene? You're supposed to be doing the scene. You're supposed to be really happy in the scene and you're, you know, a real bummer right now and you're supposed to be entertaining us. Yeah, I actually, as an actor, find that sometimes to be a challenge when it's like, you have zero time to compose yourself, especially, well, in theater, you just have to go on when 8 o'clock, 8:05 or whatever. And then in film and television, you know, you are just, you know, people come and prod at you and make sure you look right and fix your clothes and fix your microphone, fix your hair, makeup, fix your, and then once everything that's done, once the camera's ready, no one asks like if the actors are ready. Or usually no one asks that. So it's
that's
one of those things.
You're right. Good God. You know, I've only been in the business 30 years. I've never noticed anyone asking. Yeah. Well, we don't care.
You're expected to perform at any drop of a hat.
Exactly.
So it's not like you are the camera. You know, you have to make sure the lighting's right. You have to make sure everything's right with the camera. You have to make sure everything's right with whatever wardrobe, blah, blah, blah. But it's more internal, right? So I remember one time I had to do like some big stunt or something. And I was hooked up to some gear. And like someone's with me and then all of a sudden it's like action. And then I get like pulled across the room. I'm like, guys, can you just ask me if I'm ready? Or can I just give you an okay before you yank my entire body across? And that's not even performing any kind of emotion of any kind or like any kind of true acting. That's just physically, I want a little control over my body. Yeah, right. Exactly. listen, actors get a lot of perks in this business. So, but that is one thing that's kind of hard.
That's true. We should mention again, she has the largest microphone we've ever seen. So
yeah. What am I overcompensating for? I don't know. But I'm impressed, Josh, that you were able to improvise. I feel like when I was a young actor, I don't know if I would have been able to do that. And maybe I would, I don't know. But I will say there's nothing that I love more of that terrifying moment on stage when you forget your line, because it actually brings you into focus. I know we're supposed to be talking about film right now, but
that's all right.
We're talking about Blythe Spirit. No Howard. Here we are. There's that moment where it, in one sense, it takes you out. In another sense, it makes you so incredibly present. Like, you are aware you're doing a play, but it makes you so hyper. Talk about like present moment. And like time slows down and it is terrifying, but you just have to go and free fall and trust that you'll know what to say. And if it's the line, it's the line. If it's not the line. To quote Waiting for Guffman, I feel like Fred Willard, and it says something like, if there's a pause, just say a line, even if it's from another show. That's what I do. Something like that. You just say a line, even if it's from another show. And that's what you did, Josh. So that's impressive.
It was fun. I don't know. There was a great, I can't remember if it was Richard Harris telling the story about Peter O'Toole or vice versa. But we'll just go with like Peter
Old
O'Toole.
Old English actors. Yeah.
Right. Great. Yeah. Peter O'Toole's in some town in the Midlands and he walks into a pub across the street from a theater and he's going to be, and Richard Harris is sitting there. They haven't seen each other in a while. They have a couple of drinks. And then Richard Harris goes, what are you doing? He's like, oh, I'm just hanging around. He's like, come on over with me. And they walk across the street and they go to the theater and the people, you know, they say, oh my God, they open the doors. And they go up to a private little, oh my God, I'm losing my words, you know, the little.
A rehearsal space?
No. There's a play going on. They're up in the one of the little balconies. A box on the side.
A box balcony.
Yeah. And the play begins and it goes on and goes on for a while. And then the scene starts and it sort of starts going nowhere. And Peter O'Toole could tell that the actors are now just vamping. They're sort of making up lines. He goes, well, what is this? What's going on? And Richard Harris goes, they're waiting for me to make my entrance.
That's awesome. Okay. So we're ready for the next movie.
Absolutely.
The Producers, the original movie from the 1970s with Zero Mostel, 60s, I mean, Zero Mostel and Gene Wilder. This film, very highbrow again. I just love two comedy greats, like so broad and big in such an amazing way. It's something that I think of, I don't know, you know, you, as an actor, it's like you want to push as far as you can and get away with it and still be believable, right? In that world, they could go so far and it's just so delicious. So I love that film. I've never seen the remake.
You don't have to.
Yeah. I think the remake was just introduce it to a new generation, right?
Oh, wait, but Joe, did you never see that? You didn't see the play?
I saw the play and I saw the movie.
Yeah. Because I mean, I saw like the LA, it was fine. I didn't need it.
Yeah. I mean, I'd be curious to see the play. I'm curious to see the new movie too, but the original film, you can't beat it. I mean, it's just so crazy and goofy. And I don't know, like the card, but that's another thing from high school that we would reenact, not necessarily on video, but just like friends. Did you guys do that? Or is that just a thing that actors do as they're growing up where you're like, reenact movies with your friends?
No, we used to do it when I was a kid, but it would be like we would see Moby Dick and then everybody would, you know, act like they were Captain Ahab and all the other characters and for Westerns.
Yeah.
Always for Westerns.
Oh, for Westerns, sure.
Seldom other kinds of movies.
So wait, so you would run around and pretend to be like when you were, what, 12, like a vengeance-obsessed maniac trying to kill a whale? That was...
Yeah.
What do you think kids want to do? I mean, I have two boys.
I was Batman. I was always Batman.
They want to recapture the moment of what they saw in the movies, and because you know these were things we saw in the movies that were larger than life, and they were part of the world that we wanted to be part of after we came home.
That makes complete sense.
Yeah,
I grew up doing that too. What's disturbing is since COVID, I have two kids who, you know, started playing video games, and then their real life, their imaginary play became about video games. Like they would reenact Roblox games and things like that, which you probably don't even know about without something I wouldn't know about until last year. But anyway, that's disturbing. Like kids reenacting video games. At least they are playing in real life, I guess is all at least they're not allowed to play.
I just told you about the Pope brothers doing Three Stooges. I don't think any video game can compare to the awfulness.
It gets kind of violent. Some of those video games can, you have to watch out. But anyway, the producers, just so silly and great. And then the other movie I have is Boys in the Hood, which was such a big film growing up. I mean, when did that come out? In high school for me? And that was such a like LA film too. I mean, you know, I grew up in a mostly white neighborhood and a white, you know, all that, but I grew up in Los Angeles. And so I don't know. I found that movie quite moving, and I don't know. I really connected to it as a kid too. And hey, that's about guys. So I do like movies about guys as well as women. You're kind of have to, if you're a woman.
Yeah. Otherwise you have to be pretty thin picking.
Exactly. Especially when I was growing up. But
I mean, this is a banal observation, but that's kind of one of the great things that movies do is they put you in the shoes of people you are not, you know, in just very profound ways.
Yeah. So. But I guess when you're not, you don't see yourself so many times, and like, you know, by so many marginalized people have not felt that way. It's hard to get an in at all if you're never seeing anybody like yourself. I think that is probably pretty hard. I mean, hey, I'm just female. I'm white. I have a lot of privilege. I have, you know, I grew up with. I recognize all that, but I did feel that lack of gender representation for sure. Especially as I, you know, was growing up and coming of age, that meant something to me when I did see women, strong female, and I think specifically like physically strong female characters. But those are kind of what resonated with me more than like, you know, I can look at films and appreciate their beauty, or, you know, appreciate all kinds of things about what they're trying to say, what it's trying to say. But if I don't feel a connection to that, it doesn't resonate with me as much. But I didn't really realize that actually until I was like looking at films that kind of made a difference for me as I was growing up, when I was, you know, looking at things to do for this show. And I was thinking about, I think I wrote a paper on it to a certain in high school for my film class a bit, but.
Oh, on Boys in the Hood?
I'm talking about women and females and all that. I'm going back in general, philosophically trying to look at like why I like certain things. But Boys in the Hood, I think because it was so Los Angeles, it was of the time. And I don't know, I connected with those characters in a certain way. And
he did. There's a kind of especially with that film, he had I remember when I first saw it, I found it kind of annoying because I was in a very phase of really being down on this gentleman's films, but I thought it had a little bit of a sort of Spielberg veneer
on John Singleton's films in general.
It's on Spielberg's films. Yeah. The idea of sort of giving it that.
Right.
And then I went back and I saw it again a few years ago. And I actually realized that's actually kind of one of its strengths, is because it sort of invites people in who might not ordinarily I think it makes it more welcoming to people who might have been, you know, off put somehow, you know.
It's got a mainstream appeal, and that's the Spielberg element, right? I mean, Spielberg is like,
yeah, or, you know, a white appeal.
Right, and white appeal. But, I'm sure it's like, it's not necessarily, right, like it's a film that appeal, you know, that was probably intentional in many ways, right? It has the wide stream, and that includes white appeal, right? But yeah, I totally hear that. And and I don't know, I can like films that are very, you know, big, huge, huge mainstream, and, you know, kind of big and big budget, blah, 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 and that appeal to lots of people. And then the small movies too. But I think that was smart that they made that film so kind of mainstream, and probably what was stealing from the Spielberg-esque stuff that appeals.
Yeah, not so much stealing, but just sort of leaning into that kind of style of filmmaking, which was interesting. I think a lot of, there were other films around the time or after that were kind of in a similar vein, and they were always kind of going for a much, you know, more overtly kind of gritty feel to them. And I mean, there's some great ones, but yeah, that had a kind of way of sneaking past some audiences that might not otherwise have gone to see it, which is pretty cool. Wow. Well, was there any connection between you going, I want to act, and you know, anything specific, a movie you had seen? Was that, or was it just a kind of cumulative effect? Or also growing up in the house you grew up in, it might be.
Yeah, I mean, my mom's an actor, so I saw it as a profession you could do. It's so, I mean, so many actors I know who grew up, they didn't really think you could actually be an actor, or it was not acceptable.
Right. All right, your parents are doing it. Jeez,
but yeah, they have no, you know, nothing to say if we decided to go into that field, right? And we saw how hard it was. You know, we saw all kinds of, you know, family, friends, super talented actors struggling. But my first love was doing theater. So to me, it was not film, it was theater. Of course I loved films. I love movies. And, but I don't, I feel like when I, my first interest in acting came, and for many years was really just focused on theater, and, you know, didn't really think about doing films or film or TV or anything like that until later on. But I don't know. There's certain performances. I mean, I love Juliet Stevenson's performance in Truly Madly Deeply. And when I look at some films that we're talking about today, you know, and Jodie Foster and Silence of the Lambs and other films, but those are certainly inspiring to me. But I'm not the kid who grew up and was like crazy watching every movie, cinephile, clearly, right. You know, cinephile, seeing everything, being like, I want to make movies. That was not me. I didn't even know I wanted to be an actor until much later on. So, but I had an outside appreciation for them, and I knew people could do those jobs because my parents did those jobs. Right. But
yeah, that seems, that would be, I didn't even really thought about it, but yeah, there's a sort of mystification to it. I mean, Joe, you didn't, you know, like me, we didn't grow up around it. It had to be, was there had to be long parts of your life when you were young where like, that was just a thing that people who lived in a fantasy land that we would never be part of did for a living. Would that be a fair assessment when you were a kid?
Yeah, you never thought of it as something that was available for you to do.
Yeah.
You know, it's just something you enjoyed.
Yeah. But God, I imagine like, yeah, if I grew up in a house where my parents worked in it, and I was like, yeah, these clowns can do it.
Exactly. I can totally do that. I can do that. You know? I can do that.
Yeah, I can do that.
I know I finally went to Universal Studios for my son's friend's birthday, and we went on the backlot tour, and then the two other moms were doctors. And they were like, oh, we're so sorry. We didn't think about how this must be like for what for us is like touring a hospital, you know?
Yeah.
And I said, exactly. No, it's still interesting. It's still interesting as a.
Wow, a grip.
Yeah.
You say.
What?
Well, Emily, thank you so much for coming on. I'm so glad we finally got you.
Thanks a lot for lowering the brow.
You're so welcome for dumbing it all down. You can thank me.
I'm gonna send you 10 episodes that are gonna make you feel so highbrow. It's
okay. I maybe was listening to the wrong episodes. No, I
feel like anybody and if he hears this, he'll know I mean no aspersions. I think anybody who's concerned that the show is too high ground needs to listen to Eli Roth talk about his favorite terrible 80s sex comedies that ran on HBO all the time.
Yeah.
Because that will disappoint.
That's high class.
You know what?
That might have been the dumbest.
There's certain things that shape us, right? Picture. There's certain things that that shape us. And a lot of times those things are not the things that make us like intellectually stimulated. That's like the things that that connect to us. That sex comedies, yep. You know, sometimes they make you feel rather than think, I guess. So I don't know.
That's right. I wish Citizen Kane and Jules and Jim are what made me want to get into film, but you know.
Oh my God. I love Jules and Jim. And I mean, I love Citizen Kane somewhat, but Jules and Jim, one of my favorite films, but a million people can talk about that film.
Yeah,
but it isn't, exactly. I don't feel, so, I remember going to see that film, side note, with a friend and her boyfriend at the time. And he's like, what was that? That was like you were like, it was just like, you're thinking about it. I was like, that's what it was. That's what's so great about it or something. I don't know. But really, I remember are the things that make you feel. I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I have to ask, the one question is now you've come through the other end of this in one piece.
Supposedly.
Were we terrifying?
Not at all. I worry that it's like not all entertaining. And no, that
it's,
I'm going
to be great.
Once he's cut it down to 15 minutes.
And I also fear that I'm going to seem like such a like lowbrow dum-dum and I didn't do my work, but whatever. God. Who cares?
But my question is, what could I possibly have said to you, say a week or 2 weeks ago that could have gotten you past the concerns?
No, you did say, no, we love it. And you did tell me about the Eli Roth thing and that helped me.
Okay.
No, that totally helped me. If I hadn't felt that way, I would be like locked in a room watching all like, I don't know, German expressionist film. I don't know what, you know what I mean? I might be like pretending to be into something else and getting into, I don't know, rewatching things.
Frame by frame study of Dr. Kalengard. Yeah. Yes. No, guys, I do. I have one friend I'm dying to get on the show. I actually have two who would be great guests and people would love to hear. And they are both still a little intimidated. It's like, this is insane. One of them is, in fact, the person who made movies that made me want to make movies. And I'm like, you what the? And somehow it's impossible to communicate to them. We don't want to. We're not going to test you.
Well, I wonder if you play them this episode.
Here you go.
You're going to be better than this girl, believe me.
Oh, stop it. Stop it. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was fun.
Our show was recorded from several well-stocked bunkers. We can't wait to get back to beautiful downtown Burbank. We're the official podcast of TrailersFromHell.com, the best damn movie website there is. Our engineer is the composer Don Barrett, who also transmogrified, produced, and created our theme song. This is Josh Olson for The Movies That Made Me. Stay safe out there, folks.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.